go on, I just wanted to fix up one point on the last in the last lecture on the Gaussian model, the specific heat calculation, the Gaussian model, just so that we have the right results. I mean, we basically had all the right results, but they weren't presented properly. So we had derived that the okay. So here's the picture, right? This is the picture. In let me supplement this picture a bit. In mean field theory, the specific heat is zero above TC, and it jumps by an amount which we call delta C, which is the specific heat jump. Okay? In the Gaussian model, when you calculate the specific heat above TC, then it takes off like some power law. And if you compare, if you look at this region where the Gaussian specific heat rises above the mean field specific heat jump, that gives you, that characterizes or defines, if you like, a critical region where the fluctuations that are included in the Gaussian model become important, compared more important than the mean field part. Okay, so that defines this little temperature region here. And we had correctly derived that this size of this was equal to C naught over delta C, where C naught was the coefficient of the power law for the specific heat, and delta C is delta C. So so to the 2 over 4 minus D. That was a result that we derived, and if you just go back in your notes, you can see that was fine. And then, after a certain amount of discussion about what C naught actually was, we concluded that the dependence of C naught on the bare correlation length and the stiffness went like this, 1 over k C naught squared to the d over 2. Okay, so that also we had written down, although I erased the exponent a couple of times and rewrote that, but eventually we came to the conclusion that this was d over 2. Okay, so then this then gives you, when you combine, so this is 1 over C naught to the D, and then this goes like then 1 over C naught to the 2D over 4 minus D, which is in three dimensions is 1 over C naught to the 6th. And 1 over C naught squared for D equals 2. So I say that because I just wanted to emphasize the fact that the result that we get from the Gaussian model above TC is exactly the same, the prediction in terms of the width of the critical region and how it depends on the bare correlation length is exactly the same above TC for the Gaussian model and below TC for the derivation of the Ginzburg criterion that we did. Okay, so, and uh, Okay, so that's just to patch up something that wasn't presented very clearly. Okay, so now we're moving on to the very important subject of the renormalization group. So this section we'll call as Carney does, calls the renormalization group idea. And the references for this are Carney, chapter 3, and our book, chapter 21. And I encourage you to read both of those. And what I'll be doing will follow my own, you know, development more closely. Although I have to say, I've been strongly influenced by Carty. I mean, he explains things in very interesting ways. So, okay. So this idea was motivated by Kadanoff's block spin picture, and let me just say right away that we're going to apply these ideas. I mean, the renormalization group ideas that we're going to develop and discuss have broad applicability, basically to any problem where the most important thing that happens is critical behavior, which I hope everyone has understood now that that means that you have diverging length scale at someplace in your phase diagram. So any system which is exhibits critical behavior, this technique can be applied to describe and actually calculate things. However, because, you know, for this course, for this short 3-week, 15 lecture course, we're just going to continue to stick to the Ising model, which, of course, you're free to think of as a scalar 5-4 theory, too. I mean, you know, it's really not some special model concocted by eccentric mathematical physicists. It's broadly applicable. So we are considering the and in fact, for today, we're just going to consider the 1D case. Which we'll write as minus beta H is K sum over I SI, SI plus 1 minus plus H sum over I SI. We're going to add a constant. We'll come back to this in a minute. So why we do that doesn't matter for the behavior. But I just want to come back to this statement that this, what we're going to do, is motivated by Kadanoff's block spin picture. For the specific case of this 1D Ising model. I mean, so let's just draw a little picture here. So you have some spins, S1, S2, S3, S4, 5, And we're going to group them together. Oh, and they have, I like that colored chalk. They have couplings between them, K, K, so forth. I guess you don't have colored pencils. That's too bad. And the trick that we're going to use is we're going to divide these things up into blocks. And we're going to, in this particular problem, we're going to trace out half the degrees of freedom. In other words, we're going to sum over all of the even-numbered spins. And we'll be left with the odd-numbered spins. And then we're going to be left with a problem which is effectively an icing problem for the odd-numbered spins. With a new coupling constant, K prime, in such a way that the partition function that we calculate for just the odd-numbered spins with this renormalized coupling constant is exactly equal to the partition function that we would have calculated for all the spins with this coupling constant. And the new physics in this way of looking at it is, how does the coupling constant change when you do this transformation from all the spins to just the odd-numbered spins, which amounts to changing your length scale by a factor of 2 or a half, if you like. These guys here are 2 spaces apart, but that becomes 1 space in the one lattice spacing in the new system. So basically, the physics that we're going to be studying is how the effective coupling changes when we change the length scale. That's putting it in the way that you might look at it from quantum field theory. Now, I just mentioned that in Carty's book, he does things slightly differently, it took me a minute to appreciate why. So he actually has blocks of 3 spins. And what he does is he replaces each block of 3 spins by a new block spin based on the so-called majority rule. In other words, if you have more up than down, then the block spin is plus. If you have more down than up, it's minus. Okay? And so he uses that majority rule. We're doing exactly the equivalent, but the majority rule doesn't work very well for 2 spins. So we're just basically tracing out the even-numbered spins. But it's all the same thing, and you'll see that the equations that result, I'll try to point out, are exactly analogous, whether your change in length scale is a factor of 2 or a factor of 3. I mean, the physics has to be the same. You're transforming from one representation to another where the two representations have the identical partition function and free energy. Okay. However, as you'll see, there's things that you can do, you can exploit in this approach, which allow you to calculate in a different way. So it's actually highly non-trivial in some sense. Of course, it's most trivial for the 1D Ising model, which everyone knows you can solve trivially. Okay, so this is the model that we'll study for today. And then we can immediately write down the partition function. And then I'm just going to write, so you can see that the partition function, e to the minus beta h, can be written as a product of terms s1, s2, s2, s3, s3, s4, and so forth. For the magnetic field, you can also write it in a symmetrical way like this, h over 2 si. Si plus 1. And once you do this product, you pick up everything. Every spin picks up an h, a whole h. Okay. So this can then be written as e to the n a product over I odd Z SI plus 2. Okay, so now this is only over odd numbered spins, where let's call this S1, S3, for instance, just as an example of odd spins, is equal to sum over S2 equals plus or minus 1, e to the k S1, S2, plus S2, S3, plus, hope everybody can see this, h over 2, S1 plus 2, S2, plus S3. I don't know, you probably can't, well, maybe you can. What this says here, if you can't see that, is h over 2. So basically what we've done is we've divided the partition function up into, I think I need a trace there. I think I need a trace here, right? So we've divided the trace up into two. Is that okay? Yeah, these are sort of partial partition functions. Yeah. So if I've done this right, I've divided the trace up into the trace over the odd-numbered spins of some factors where the trace over the even-numbered spins has already been done. Is that clear? Okay. And then you can do this sum here. And basically what you get is See, this H over 2, S1, and S3 just comes out. And then the rest is so the sum over S2 just gives you e to the k S1 plus S3 plus e to the minus k S1 plus S3, which is the cosh. And it actually carries along with it factors of e to the h over 2, e to the h S2 plus summed over plus and minus. So basically, you get the cosh here. Okay, you can check that. So we're going to, what we want to do here is write the partition function actually as a product of factors some constant. Okay, so we know what these factors are. We know what these factors are in terms of the original coupling constants H and K. But we would like to write them in this form, because if we can do that and we put that back into this product in the partition function, then we've come back to exactly the same form as the original Ising-Hamilton, as the original Ising model. Okay? So that's the question. How do you write these things as exponential of an Ising-Hamiltonian? And the answer is, well, it's really easy, actually. If you just take the log of both sides of this equation, you can write the log So the log of this with both of these positive is a prime minus 2a plus okay. So I just put in that both spins are plus and take the log of both sides. And log of z plus minus is equal to log z minus plus, which is a prime minus 2a. So what happens here, if they have opposite signs, you get 0 here, and you get minus k prime. And then the minus minus is a prime minus 2a. Minus plus k prime minus h prime. That's just setting them both equal to minus up here. So now you can see that you can solve for the coupling constants, A prime, K prime, and H prime, in terms of some nonlinear function of the original coupling constants. And the result is simply easily checked. So that's just like adding this plus twice this plus this. And you just, it's only the A prime plus two A's that survive. K prime is equal to a quarter log Z plus plus Z minus minus over Z plus minus squared. And H prime is a half log Z plus plus over Z minus minus. Bring this up a little bit, where just using this again is 2e to the h cosh 2k plus h. Oh, sorry. Let me just pull this down for a second. Yeah. 2k plus h. Better keep that. Let me just write it up here. Z plus minus is equal to 2 cosh h. And Z minus minus is equal to 2 e to the minus h cosh 2k minus h. So now we're free to take this constant term in our starting Hamiltonian to be zero, but you can see right away that even if this constant is zero to start with, it becomes non-zero after this step. Okay. So now, let me put this up. see all that? Yeah. Okay. So now, I guess the question you might want to ask yourself is, how do these new coupling constants compare to the old ones? And if you do this repeatedly, what happens to them? Okay. So just to make our life simple, let's consider in that case, Z plus plus is the same as Z minus minus, is 2 cosh 2k. And Z plus and minus is just 2. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's up there. So the recursion relation for K prime is a quarter of the log and so forth, but you end up with something squared, so it's a half of the log of cosh 2k. Okay? So this is called a recursion relation. And the question that you want to address is, what happens if you do this repeatedly? If you start with a k, generate a k prime, put that in here, generate a k double prime, and so forth. And it should be pretty obvious that that k prime is less than k, because basically, if you just exponentiate this, then e to the 2k prime is just the average of e to the 2k and 1 over that. So it just gets smaller every time, assuming k is positive. And it's equal for k equals 0. I mean, if k equals 0, k prime is 0. So using this equation, you can draw something which is called a renormalization group flow diagram. And basically, it looks like this. If this point represents t equals 0, which is k equals infinity, and this point represents t equals infinity, which is k equals 0, then basically k flows from large values to 0. If you like, the coupling constant flows to infinite temperature, or zero coupling. Okay. So after you do this renormalization a few times, you have a non-interacting system, basically. And let's see, what happens if k is, well, we'll see later. We'll talk about that. But k, this is a fixed point. If k is infinite, k prime is infinite. And if k is 0, k prime is 0. Yes, Nicole. K is J over T. That's probably here. If you didn't have the beta, then this would be minus J. The Ising model has minus J times the product of neighboring spins, minus the local field H times the linear, times the sum of the spins and so forth. So K. Yeah, but you can't tell the difference between a system with some coupling constant at some temperature and a larger coupling constant or the same coupling constant at a lower temperature, if you see what I'm saying. Or, no, I didn't say it quite right. For a given, yeah, you get the idea, yeah. Yeah,
all right.
I'm sorry, you're saying which lecture? One of mine or one of Francois? Right, yeah, yeah, that's right. There are deep analogies between the two systems, for sure. And everything behaves the same. Modulo some wick rotation or something like that. Okay. Yeah, it's the same problem. This is what I tried to emphasize that at the beginning, but you can't overemphasize it. This is not a very specialized problem. This is the whole problem that you guys will be studying. Although this part of it is solved already, but nevertheless, you need to understand it. Okay. So, so I guess they'll do a little more on this. In the tutorial. Yeah. So remember those recursion relations. Probably Anna's written them down for you. Maybe not. Okay. Okay, so we've basically showed how to transform some Hamiltonian with coupling constants into an equivalent Hamiltonian with fewer degrees of freedom, renormalized coupling constants, which has the same partition function. So the next thing we would like to do is use this to just solve the problem. In other words, what you mean by solve the problem for a statistical mechanical problem is to calculate the free energy as a function of the coupling constants K and H. Once you've calculated the free energy, you can calculate anything. Okay, so let's do that. Where should we do it? Let's do it here. Okay, so next, that's the free energy per spin. Okay, so the partition function for n spins is e to the na times e to the nf. That's just like saying that the free energy to within a constant, additive constant, is the log of the partition function. And because of the way we did the RG transformation, we preserve the value of the partition function. Some place up there it should say that. Right, it's implicit there. And this is, okay, so this is the key, if you like. Write it that way. So why am I able to write it like this? Okay, so we wrote the partition function. The partition function is, or the free energy is defined this way. We calculated a new partition function which has half the number of spins, but we normalized coupling constants, and we know that we can write that new partition function in this way. Why is that? What's special here? Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I guess what I would emphasize is that we transformed the system into another icing model. So this function f is the same function of k prime and h prime as this function f is of k and h. Because it's both icing models, they have the same form for the partition function. That's the key here. Yes. So if you take the log of both sides, you get that A plus F of K and H is equal to 1/2 A prime plus F of K prime and H prime. And actually, you could, I guess you could do this again and say that this is 1 over 2 to the n. After doing this n times, and so what you really want to know then is how these renormalized coupling constants, where they go, if you like, for large numbers of iterations. You can express your free energy in terms of, you know, at any stage here. But in principle, large n might be simple. Okay, and that's a fair bit. So now we're going to try to do this. We're going to calculate the free energy. Let's just make our lives simple. Consider H equals 0. So the initial starting A is 0. That's just the constant. We don't have to carry along. Then the recursion relations tell us that k n plus 1 is a half log cosh 2k n. And a n plus 1 is 2a n plus I was feeling there's some equation I didn't write down. Yeah, I guess, yeah. So this is the top line. A prime is 2a plus, there's a bunch of squares there, so it's only 1 half log plus. Must have written that. Yeah, plus is 2 cosh 2k minus is also 2 cosh 2k. Yeah, so that's where these guys come from. And then there's a log 2 because they're all 2. Yeah. 2, 4, 16. Yeah, anyway, that's... You guys can see it as well as I can. So where does this get us? Then A of 1 is equal to, this is 0 for 0. So it's a half log cosh 2k. Plus log 2, k of 1 is 1 half log cosh 2k, that's the first iteration, and then the second iteration is this. Oh, I see. Yeah. So A2 is 2A1. A1 is this, so that's 1 half log cosh 2k plus log 2. I see. No, it's 2A1. So so that's this, plus 1 half log of cosh of 2k of 1. Well, let's not write it that way. Well, okay, we can write it that way, sort of backwards from in my notes. Plus log 2, and this thing here is
Sorry.
This thing here is log cosh 2k. Yes, okay. So basically, what I've got here is I've got the second constant, A2, is written as 1/2 the log of the cosh of the log of the cosh of the starting coupling constant plus the log of the cosh of the coupling constant plus 2 log 2. Okay. Actually, so, okay, good, I do rewrite this. 3 log 2 plus log cosh 2k plus 1/2 log cosh 2k. And actually, you can go on, okay? And I, you know, without working through the algebra, I'll just write down. So A of 3 is 7 log 2 plus 2 log cosh 2k plus And then you can actually, let's see, what do I want to say here? This free energy is going to go to 1 over 2 to the n, A of n, as n goes to infinity. Because basically, see, we had an expression for where is it? Oh, here, right here. So, referring back to this, A is 0, f of k and h, I'm saying, is going to go to 1 over 2 to the n times the nth iteration of A. And the reason is that this guy for 0 magnetic field is going to go to 0. OK? And so that's what I was just going to say, because 1 over 2 n to 1 over 2 to the n, f k n 0, goes to 1 over 2 to the n log 2 goes to 0. OK, so what does that mean? So I'm trying to argue why this term goes to zero in zero field after many iterations. And it's simply the fact that K is going to go to zero. The free energy for zero coupling in zero field is just log 2. Just the spin can be up or down. And there's a 1 over 2 to the n out in front, so that's zero. Yes?
I'm probably forgetting something that we wrote, but in our recursion relations for, so we have recursion relations for K, A, and
H. Right. We're taking H equals zero, and it doesn't, once H is zero, it stays zero. Okay, so is that what you're wondering about? Yes, okay, yeah. So why is it that as you iterate, you start out with A equals zero, you generate A, you start out with H equals zero, and I haven't mentioned the fact that you don't generate any H. So let's look at that. You can see if you look at what H prime would be, it's the ratio of Z plus plus to Z minus minus, and if you look at what Z plus plus right below it and Z minus minus are when H equals zero, okay, let's do it. One half log, well, it's just, yeah. So it's just zero. Yeah. It's zero. Yeah. Sorry. It's making it more complicated than I needed to. Yeah. So H stays zero. Actually, I guess the problem that you're going to look at later is what happens when H is not zero. Okay, so so what's our bottom line here? So I've written down A1, A2, A3, and I've told you that the free energy is 1 over 2 to the n An in the limit as n goes to infinity. Okay, believe it or not, I've actually written out enough to allow you to extrapolate this series, or the sequence, it's a sequence, I guess, yes, because it's two terms here, three terms here, four terms here, and so forth, and it gets longer and longer. But you can actually extrapolate it to infinity and divide by 1 over 2 to the n, and the result is something which I guess I'll write. Let's put this one up. And put this one down. This is a little bit unsatisfying, but the log 2 comes from the fact that you've got log 2 with a 1, a 3, a 7, and so forth. And when you divide by 2 to the n, you end up getting a 1. Okay. So this is the unsatisfying part, because even though I've written out a lot of long equations here, there's a few equations that are too long for even me to write down. So you can show that. Is, oh, sorry, with the 1/4 out in front, is log cos k. And Well, I leave it to you. It's actually worked out in our book, so you can see, or you can do it yourself. Which is a result that you've derived in tutorials. But the point is this okay so far? I mean, I apologize for this, but it's just the way it is. In general, however, you can calculate the free energy for any field and coupling constant. Yes, Alex? Which one? This one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So this one comes. So let's say, let's look at this expression for A1, A2. Well, I can't do that. But A2 and A3. Okay? And now you want to extrapolate to what does the expression look like for large N or general N, okay? The coefficient of the log 2 then I'm using this expression here. The left-hand side is just F because the starting A is 0. And the right-hand side is 1 over 2 to the N times the sum of two terms, the nth iterated A and F with the iterated coupling constants. And remember, we're working with H equals 0. Okay? So I argued here that this F, this guy here, when n is large and h is 0, goes to log 2, because it's basically the free energy of a spin with no couplings. Okay, and that's just, you know, z is 2 for that case. And because of the 1 over 2 to the n, that then goes to 0 when n is large. Okay, does that answer that? So basically, this is just 1 over 2 to the n, a of n. Okay, so that's a long, tedious calculation. Let's do a slightly simpler calculation. Okay, so now we want to calculate the correlation length as a function of the coupling constant, and yeah, please. No, no, no. This is valid for arbitrary k. Which one are you pointing at?
The fk0.
This thing here is valid for arbitrary k. The only place where I took k near 0 was to say that the second term, if you iterate many times, you can start from k as large as you want. If you then keep renormalizing and renormalizing, it goes to 0 actually rather quickly. So this second term here goes to log 2 when in 0 field, only in 0 field, it goes to log 2. And then when you divide by 2 to the n, you get 0. This other term, a for large n, has factors in it which cancel out the 2 to the n. And so then you get this series, this infinite series, which actually can be summed to give you log cosh k. So that's exact. Okay, so let's make sure, you know, if you don't, if that's not clear, ask again. So, I mean, yes, Ruben. Once you've written down the recursion relations, it's really easy. I mean, numerically, it's really easy to iterate it. So there's no reason to stop. You see what I mean? Like, if you were just doing this numerically, it would just be, there'd be nothing to it. And probably Mathematica has some special way of doing it instantly. So yeah, there's no real need to do it approximately. I mean, of course, this is a totally trivially exactly solvable problem, so that's... Yeah, but in general, if you've actually written down the recursion relations, you're really essentially there. Okay, so, good. So we're going to calculate the correlation length for h equals 0. And the recursion relation for h equals 0, I'm just going to rewrite this by exponentiating it, multiply through by 2 and exponentiating it. So e to the 2k prime is cosh 2k. And this is exactly equivalent to saying that tanh k prime is tanh squared. Every time I see that, I think, oh yeah, how do you do that? It's and basically, the way to see this is just this is e to the 2k prime is this. And then you can use this to construct the tanh. You just take e to the 2k prime. You take cosh 2k plus 1 over, or sorry, cosh 2k minus 1 over cosh 2k divided by cosh 2k plus 1 over cosh 2. In other words, you use this to construct the tanh. When you do that and you multiply everything out and you use a identity that tells you cosh 2k is 2 cosh squared k minus 1, you then get tanh squared. So I just, you know, leave that as a little bit of algebra. So that's sort of interesting because it shows you how the renormalization works. Whatever k is, you take its tanh and square it, and you get the tanh of a new k. That's sort of cute. So if we define this says that x prime is equal to x squared. And so, what about the correlation function? The correlation length, sorry. The correlation length now I mean, the RG step is basically integrating out half of the spins. So the correlation length in terms of the new coupling constant is half of the original coupling constant because our unit of length, I guess, is doubled. So in terms of, yeah. So basically, the correlation length has been divided in half.
Why is there a k prime on one side and a k
Sorry. Good question. Another good question. Thank you. Okay. So so this is and then you can immediately solve that. This basically says that is equal to something, some constant over log x. And so you can see that if you square that, you bring out a 2. And so so in terms of the original coupling constant K and the temperature, because remember K is J over T, the correlation length goes like 1 over log tanh K. And if you then put in, so then you want to take, so the question is what happens as T goes to 0 or K goes to infinity, tanh K goes to 1 minus 2e to the minus 2k. Okay, just, yeah.
It looks like we define psi in terms of a and lx. How can we make that choice?
Because of this equation here, that when you iterate, you get the square of the variable, and this function satisfies that it, you know, the square of the variable gives you 1/2 the original thing. That's the property of the log, and that's pretty much you know, the whole story there. So now if you write, so for large k, the tanh is 1 minus 2 times a very tiny number, and the log of 1 minus a tiny number is minus that tiny number. And so this then goes to just by putting this inside the logarithm here, you get rid of the minus sign and just get. So basically what this says is that when k goes to infinity, the correlation length, which corresponds to t goes to 0, the correlation length diverges exponentially with 2k. And I think that's exactly the result that you guys calculated in the second tutorial without the a. I think A was 1. Yeah.
So in the definition of the correlation, like why is X minus the
algebra? Well, so normally the correlation length depends on temperature, right? And it has some dependence, which in fact is you've calculated it as e to the 2j over t in that tutorial. So normally it would depend on k or temperature. But we've written it as a function of x, which is just tanh k. So that's uniquely defined. Because the renormalization group transformation takes x into x squared. Or it obeys this. So this relation tells you how k scales under renormalization. It's tanh It's the new k is tan of the new k is the square of the tan of the previous k. Okay, and because of this scaling relation, the correlation length at x squared is 1/2 the correlation length at x, where x is tan k. Okay, I mean, I'm not really doing anything too tricky. I could just as well write this as the correlation length as a function of k, which is equal to the inverse tangent of x or something like that. Let me just tell you something interesting about what Cardi does. Okay? So in Cardi does exactly the same calculation, except, as I said at the beginning of the class, his block is 3 spins, and he uses the majority rule, but every step of his calculation is rigorous. I mean, he doesn't make any approximations, okay? So he gets to the end, and in his calculation, this expression here would be 1/3, because the rescaling is 3. And when you work through what he does, he shows you his tan k prime is the original tan k cubed. Okay? So everything goes through in exactly the same way. You get this log. In the end, you get this tan k. You get this result exactly. But he does it with a different blocking. Okay, and so it's useful to look at that because then you can sort of see how things work. With, you know, if you change the size of the block, how does it change the algebra? The answer better be the same. Yes, Nicole.
The line that starts with S2 approaches 0. Tan k approaches, is that 1.2?
One minus two. So tan, it's just tan k. And then you just divide through by e to the k, numerator, denominator, and expand everything out. Yes?
So is your approach, your rule is different from Cardi's rule? This rule is the majority rule, but the rule is taking over the...
every other spin, right, even numbered spins. Yeah. Yeah, you have to look at how he does it. When he puts in the majority rule, he does everything exactly. He doesn't make any approximations. So it's a question of you have to count how many states correspond to majority up and how many states correspond to majority down, and he does it all exactly. Okay? So he gets the exact answer. So if this theory is right, it shouldn't matter precisely how you choose your blocks, okay? Or what kind of, as long as, okay, so there's two things. For solving 1D Ising models, you're free to choose your blocks any way you want as long as you carry through the calculation exactly and don't make any approximations, okay? And you better get the same answer, okay? And you can try it with 5 spins, or you can try this thing with blocks of 4 and trace out 3 of them or whatever you want. You'll always get the same answer as long as you just follow through, you know, calculate the partition function exactly. Okay. Now, the problem arises in higher dimension, where you can't actually derive the exact recursion relation. And this is exactly the subject of tomorrow's lecture. I mean, starting out with why, what goes wrong. So I should say, in this calculation, nothing went wrong, But the result is trivial because you just flow from large coupling constant to zero coupling constant. That's it. That's the end of the story for 1D. Okay. In higher dimension, where remember you have phase transitions at non-zero temperatures, the flow is more complicated. Okay, you don't just flow to infinite temperature because it matters whether you're above or below the transition temperature. So in that sense, the flow diagram is much more interesting. But the problem is that when you try doing these, dividing things up to blocks, if you start out with a nearest neighbor icing model, you do one step, and all of a sudden, your new Hamiltonian is not just a nearest neighbor icing model. Yes? This one? You've got two fixed points. This is a repulsive fixed point. This is zero temperature. Corresponds, it's like infinitely strong coupling constant. It's unstable. And so the flow is away. This is infinite temperature or zero coupling constant. It's stable, the flow is to it, and nothing else happens in between. That's the physical significance of this phase, this flow diagram. It's all one phase. That's the point. Nothing happens in between. So it's all a single phase. Nicole. Means you have a refrigerator and you start out with the temperature at zero, absolute zero, if you know how to do that, and then you crank it up to infinite. That's what it means. I mean, it's not an experiment that you can easily do. However, on the for a given system with some bare coupling constant, which is you might find in nature, we know how to go to temperatures which are really small and really large compared to this naturally occurring coupling constant. So we can almost change the temperature from zero to infinity, but not quite.
So if we start off with one of these systems at T at equals zero, is it the actual physical temperature or an analog to temperature? Do people typically measure the actual temperature in order to, let's say, check?
You can do measurements where you change the actual physical temperature and see what happens, say, to the free energy or the correlation length and things like that. Okay, what this your standard statistical mechanics problem? You do a calculation, say, of the free energy as a function of parameters, which might include temperature and field, and it predicts what happens to the properties as a function of those coupling constants as you crank them up and down. The thing that's special about this RG is that it connects energy scales, coupling constant scales, which are all normalized by T. It connects those to length scales, okay, in particular to this correlation length scale. And that's saying something about the underlying physics, what's going on, that the changing the coupling constants changes the length scales, it changes the effective interactions, and so forth. And that's just one another way of solving, or how should I say it, of describing the solution to the problem.
Mm-hmm. So if you choose like 3 or 4 rather than 2, then in the final result, do you still get A over 2?
Yeah, that'll be the same. Yeah, what'll be different is like this equation here will be different. But when you get down to the end, it's still going to be some multiplicative factor, and your correlation length is changing by some factor depending on what you choose. So those things, I guess, cancel out, basically, and you get the right answer. Okay, so so that's it for today. Tomorrow we'll go on to higher dimension.
Thank you.